This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
On January 31st of 2023, Lindsay Clancy woke up in a hospital bed at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She had just been taken off a breathing tube and she was paralyzed from the jump. That was supposed to kill her. A chaplain named Sheila Kavanaugh sat beside her and held her hand in this moment of chaos. I don't know any other way to express it. Clancy's first words, "I'm so glad that my children are safe." 7 days earlier, she had strangled all three of them. Kavanaugh did not correct her. She answered the way a chaplain answers, telling Lindsay her children were safe and in heaven with God. Then the two of them prayed. On the 17th day of the Clancy murder trial, that hospital room went in front of the jury, and the testimony took about 20 minutes. Those 20 minutes handed the jury the question this whole case turns on. What do 12 people have to believe about this woman to decide the voice in her head was never real? Because that's what the prosecution certainly wants. They want you to believe that is a fabrication. Okay, well, let's play a little game of how do we get there. Kavanaugh testified that Clancy talked about a voice, a male voice, persistent, with a command, kill the children and then herself. If she didn't obey, the voice told her neither she nor the children would be safe. Kavanaugh said Clancy returned to it across multiple visits. Then prosecutor Jennifer Sprague stood up and landed the end of the day. Kavanaugh kept notes on her visits. The notes covered her interactions, her thoughts, her feelings, and Sprague asked whether the notes ever once recorded Clancy saying she heard a voice or what that voice said. And Kavanaugh answered, correct, never once, not in the notes. That's a real point. And it deserves straight treatment. A witness described years of conversations about a voice, and in her own paperwork never mentions it. Sprague's job is to find gaps like that, and she found this one with a single question. This is the job of an attorney, of a prosecutor, of a defense attorney, whatever role you're playing, you're looking for gaps. The gap matters because of who the burden or who carries the burden in this courtroom. Nobody disputes what happened inside the house on January 24th of 2023, except people on the internet who seem to know better. The defense agrees Lindsay Clancy is the one behind this. She strangled Cora, Dawson, and Callan with exercise bands. The only question left in this trial is the condition of her mind while she did it. That's really what is on trial here. Massachusetts law puts that question on the prosecution. This is important. Clancy raised a lack of criminal responsibility defense, which is the legal name for an insanity defense. And once she raised it, she stopped having to prove anything. She's not the one who has to prove she was in a psychotic state. It's now the state, the Commonwealth, has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was criminally lucid, having an ordinary Tuesday. Everything was good and fine. And if you've been watching the trial, pretty much every piece of evidence has shown her brain was nowhere near a condition of just another Tuesday, and she's just completely with it. That means proving she had no mental disease at all, or proving that even sick, she still understood the wrongfulness of what she was doing and could have stopped herself. That's what they have to prove on the state's part. Prove a woman wasn't psychotic beyond a reasonable doubt. The voice sits at the center of that fight. So the state has to convince 12 jurors, or 18 actually in this case, the voice was never real. There are only two roads to get to that conclusion. Road one, the chaplain can't be trusted. And let's take a look at who that road runs through. Kavanaugh visited Clancy about 14 times at the hospital, then kept coming back on her own, roughly 200 visits at Tewksbury Hospital across 3 years. Nobody pays her to testify. She isn't a hired expert building a report for either side. And by her own account, she wasn't there to evaluate anyone. She also acknowledged that parts of what a patient tells a chaplain stay confidential. So this whole gotcha thing is kind of like going to a priest and saying, well, what did they tell you in confession? Those things can't make it into a courtroom. They don't have to make it in a courtroom. Which means her notebook that prosecution's pointing at going, why didn't you write this down? Was never built to be a medical chart. She may be the one witness in this trial with no stake in the outcome. And she may be just the most neutral party in all of this. And one of the roads you kind of got to go down if you're going to say that the voices aren't real, one possibility, and hear me out, there's going to be two, so just before, but what about, there's going to be two, would be having to say the chaplain is lying. Basically, you're saying the priest is lying. I know she's a chaplain, just saying priest for the sake of it. Well, she may not be lying. Lindsay may have told her that. Yes, you're right. That is road number two, where Lindsay was trying to convince the chaplain she was hearing voices. Lindsay Clancy lied to her. That would be the other road you'd have to go down to believe that she was not in a state of psychosis and this is all one big ruse. So following that, let's follow what that requires. It requires a woman who woke up paralyzed, learned her children were dead by her own hands, and within days began planning a false story with a chaplain. Then it requires her to carry that lie through 3 years and 200 visits with a person whose notes she had no reason to think would ever reach a courtroom. It also requires her to beat a professional. Defense psychologist Paul Zeisel spent more than 35 hours with Clancy. And part of the forensic evaluation is testing for malingering, which means faking symptoms for a benefit. He testified he found none. No malingering. No faking. Prosecutors went after Zeisel hard. Errors in his report and the dual role of treating Clancy while working for her defense. But attacking the evaluator is not the same as producing evidence she faked. Above all, it requires her to be a kind of person the prosecution's own case never produced. The state called roughly 70 witnesses across 3 weeks. Those witnesses described a labor and delivery nurse who loved her job and loved her children. Prosecutors allege her motive was that she wanted to die and didn't trust anyone else to raise her kids. And even that theory describes attachment. Nowhere in that testimony did anyone describe a manipulator or a liar. Neither did the man who lost the most. The man who half of the country thinks somehow did this, despite there being absolutely no evidence in that direction whatsoever. Just a lot of icky feelings and a lot of projection and a lot of people that find Patrick Clancy triggering. And I don't know why. I had this conversation last night with my wife. I'm like, why? What is going on here? Why is Patrick Clancy, the man that kind of looks like Seth Meyers? As I was trying to figure out, what does he look like? I've heard a lot of people say he looks like Koberger. I'm like, he looks like Seth Meyers a lot more than Koberger. I don't know. He doesn't feel, there's a lot of figures that we cover that seem to be triggering for whatever reason. Patrick Clancy is the one that a lot of people are projecting their own shit onto. I don't. Is it the trip? Is it the fact that he went on to Costa Rica and went hiking by himself and then stayed in hostels across Europe because he didn't want to be in an environment where he'd have to see families and he would have to have people be asking him questions constantly at home and being bombarded by every person every time he moved himself out of his home where this horrific incident happened. People everywhere coming up to him. I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh. All of it. Is it the trip? I don't know. Not trying to make this about Patrick here, but I'm trying to understand where this goes off the rails so badly. I know he left a review on a hiking site about it being a great trip, a good hike, basically. Let me just pause here for a second on that. Because everybody goes, if that happened to me, I hope you wouldn't be on a trip to Costa Rica hiking and leaving a review on a hiking site. Fair enough. And when I look at that, I go, kind of weird that you're taking a trip 20 some days after this all happened. But then I took a moment and I said, let me try and put myself in his shoes. Let me try and put myself in the world of where this is happening. Number one, I don't know that I'd still be alive. I'm going to be completely honest with you right there. I think it'd have to be someone restraining me. If I had lost my three children and my wife is still alive and she did it, and I'm trying to wrestle with what that is. But my three people, I don't know that I'd make it to 20 days, to be 1,000% honest with you. So to go, well, here's what I would do in that situation. If I had a straight up answer, I'd be lying to you. I can't contemplate what the hell that would be like. I don't think you could either, honestly. Maybe you could. I don't know. I'm one who my brain is always going down the 50 tendrils of what if. This is one where my brain just goes, overload. We don't know how this would compute. And I hope to never have to ever be in that sort of a situation. But looking at it from his perspective, what will be coming at somebody? This horrible thing happened. You're trying to figure out life. What do you do? Do you even go forward? Or do you sit in the corner and just stop eating? Or eat yourself to death, or drink yourself to death, or take a handful of pills, or find that revolver that's sitting in the cabinet. I mean, there's a lot of things that could go through one's mind if you're Patrick Clancy after this. What does a trip to Costa Rica by himself and then staying in hostels tell me? That sounds like a I need to go find myself sort of journey. After an event like that, yeah, I get it. It doesn't read that weird when you hear all that. Or do you stay home where you walk out to the grocery store or to a restaurant or to anything whatsoever outside of the confines of the home where this horrible thing just happened, where you shared life with your wife? And I'm sure looking around is going to completely make you just want to die. You need to get the hell out of Dodge if you're going to stay alive. Everyone naysaying at you, be damned. I'd be getting the fuck out of the country too. Not because of anything wrong, because I need to heal my brain if I'm going to continue participating in this exchange of oxygen that we all do with each other on this mortal coil called Earth. I don't blame him. He didn't exactly rush off to go to sandals with his mistress. There was no mistress. There was no other woman. He went off by himself, went on a hike, told other people he sweated a lot on the hike, but it was worth it. It was beautiful. Maybe he got something out of it. Maybe he found some peace. Maybe there was a moment on that hike where he felt the presence of his children. I don't know. But everyone wants to condemn the man for leaving a couple nice words on a website about a hike he took. And then somehow, oh, you're in Costa Rica. That must mean, what does it mean? What does it mean? Sue in Ohio, what does it mean? You tell me. You tell me what you did after your three children were taken off this planet by your spouse and how you dealt. What does it mean? Very few people can ever be in that position to answer that question of what they would do. And I'll tell you what, it ain't none of us. Anyway, I'll get off that rant. Days after the killings, Patrick Clancy released a statement asking the public to find it within themselves to forgive Lindsay, as he had. Is Patrick Clancy injuring people because he's such a kind of a rare character, someone who can actually find forgiveness and not live in the shadow of darkness and the shadow of rage and the shadow of retribution that so many of us live in, where we got to get back at somebody. We got to find this. The fact that he is the one above all who should be searching for the demon in this case and wanting it destroyed. The fact that he isn't doing that, is that what is causing all of this rage? He's not doing it, so society needs to step in, and we're mad that he didn't do it to go after the evildoer in this, so he's evil too because he forgave. Is that the connect the dot pattern here that we're looking at? I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out because it does not align with fact. He wrote that the real Lindsay was generously loving towards everyone. Him, the kids, her patients, the person with the most reason to call her a monster refused to. The state has one more version of Road 2, and this one points at the psychologist and said prosecutors suggested Zeisel coached Clancy to invent the hallucinations. Well, he denied it under oath. A suggestion has a calendar problem. Zeisel first reached Clancy's bedside on February 4th of 23 under a court order her defense team obtained. The chaplain heard, "I'm so glad that my children are safe," on January 31st. The sentence existed before the man accused of coaching it actually ever met her. The prosecution does have one piece of this argument that's stronger than the rest, and it should be said plainly. Before January 24th, the voice appears nowhere. Her medical records from the weeks before the killings contain no report of voices, and Zeisel acknowledged that on the stand. The silence wasn't for lack of chances. Clancy checked herself into the McLean Hospital, a psychiatric hospital, on New Year's Day of 23 and stayed until January 5th. After discharge, her outpatient psychiatrist, Jennifer Tufts, saw her by video four times, and the last appointment came on January 23rd, the day before the killings. Asked at trial whether Clancy ever said she was planning to kill the children, Tufts answered no. By Zeisel's account, she described a voice on February 6th and a call to Patrick from her hospital bed. The call went out on Zeisel's phone on speaker with him listening. A defense psychiatrist offered one explanation for that silence, and it's pretty easy to understand. We see it in our chat. We see a lot of mothers talking about this. Mothers conceal psychotic symptoms out of fear their children will be taken away. Well, they should be honest. Well, yeah, there's a lot of shouldas. And that's a very real fear. Because if you're feeling you can control this, where is this coming from? This is not who I am. This urge, that's not me. I can control this over here. And me controlling it is a better option than the system taking my children away and giving them to strangers. That's the math equation that's running through a lot of mothers' heads. And the jury can weigh that. But standing alone, a symptom that first appears once, a murder charge is waiting, looks convenient. And the state knows it, and they're trying to make a big point about it, even if it is fact. The timing argument has a problem, and the prosecution built it themselves. They pulled Clancy's phone and put her search history in front of the jury to prove planning. That same extraction shows that she was typing help in the weeks before January 24th. In late December 22, she searched about insomnia and bipolar disorder. In January, postpartum depression. And less than a week before the killings, a forensic examiner testified she searched symptoms of postpartum psychosis. The searches sit inside a wider paper trail. Police seized her journals from the house, and the final entries came within a week of the killings. The defense read one line to the jury, "I'm drowning every day." Another entry described her mind trying to make something physically wrong with her out of desperation for a break from caring from everyone. She put it in writing. for prescriber two. She told psychiatric nurse practitioner Rebecca Jo Lotta that she didn't know how she felt on Remeron, an antidepressant. And she wrote that she started having very intrusive thoughts that I never had before. What does that mean? What are those thoughts? Well, that's unfortunately where the question stopped. Juletta testified she never saw psychosis or mania in their sessions, which means the thoughts arrived in writing while a woman in front of her still looked composed. And for whatever reason, tell me about those thoughts. Wasn't something noted. That doesn't mean they weren't there. The record was built before any charge existed and before any defense needed building. It was a woman with a phone and a notebook tracking her own mind as it slid, recognizing this is not me. None of it can be backdated. A person who invents a psychotic voice after the fact has no reason to research psychosis before the fact. The state's timing theory says the symptom arrived on schedule right when the defense needed it. The state's own exhibits show her circling it while her children were still alive. So no, the prosecution will still have its case for control at closings. Witness described Clancy playing in the snow with her kids that afternoon and taking her daughter to a doctor's appointment. Prosecutors paired her phone's check of Patrick's drive time with medical testimony about how long strangulation takes and argued the math is planning. The jury will have to hold that math in one hand and the paper trail in the other. Closing arguments are expected very soon. 12 of the 18 seated jurors will deliberate. The law hands them the Commonwealth's whole burden, proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Lindsay Clancy was responsible for what she did. Whatever they decide, the verdict has to pass right through that hospital room. Her first words when the tube came out, "I'm so glad my children are safe." If the voice was real, that sentence is the sound of it still working. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.